bring the meeting to order, the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee, and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine?
Here.
Representative Dean?
I am here as well.
Representative Hertaus?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe? Representative Lohmer?
Here.
Representative Lucero?
Here.
Representative Neuberger?
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill?
Here.
Representative Quam?
Present.
Representative Rosenthal? Representative Schoen?
Schoen.
Here. Representative Ward?
Here.
Representative Winkler? And Representative Zerwas.
Okay, we got a quorum. Will somebody move the minutes of February 10th?
So moved.
All right. Representative Considine moves the minutes of February 10th with no corrections. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
All right. We have a bill in front of us today, a House File 191. Representative Kreisch's bill, Maltreatment of Minors, Governing Report Provisions Provided, and we're going to move this bill. Who would like to move the bill to HHS Finance? Representative Howe?
I would like to move this House File 191 in front of the committee and be referred to, where's it going?
HHS Finance.
HHS Finance.
Okay, Representative Howe moves the bill, House File 191, he recommended to pass and refer to HHS Finance. And Representative Kreisch, Representative Johnson, do you have a question? Oh. Representative Kreisch here?
Yes.
I already do a bill.
Thank you.
Huh? Yeah, you're up. Yeah.
Come on, everybody.
I apologize.
You're up. We already moved your bill for consideration, and you can begin your.
I was doing my last kind of backroom deal
presentation.
For everybody.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. You have in front of you House File 191 with the amendment, the author's amendment that I'd like to have you take up and move. And this is just simply to get the bill in the shape that I'd like, and I can explain that. So I believe you have to take the amendment up first. And there is one technical.
Okay, Representative Kreisch would like to move his author's amendment A5.
Mm-hmm.
Who would, Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move this amendment, but we need a technical amendment to the amendment on line 1.1. Instead of first engrossment, it should say second engrossment.
1.1.
On the amendment.
Okay. On the first line, instead of saying the first engrossment, should say the second. Okay, if everybody would incorporate that into the amendment. Okay, so Representative Howe, do you move, or Representative Johnson, move the A5 amendment as amended? I'll get it in shape the author would like. Without any objections, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill and the amendment are offered, and go ahead, Representative Kreisch.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'll run through from a framework perspective of what we're trying to accomplish here, and then I'm sure there'll be some testifiers. But first and foremost, I'll give you a history on this. This bill has come as the product of the Governor's Task Force on Child Protection. Back in last year, we had a death in Polk County that has kind of spurred this on, and the governor put together a task of 26 members, four legislators, and that task force has come up with 35 recommendations. Our final recommendations are due March 31st, but this is the recommendations that we called out that we think we can make the most impact and we can move along quickly. As I've been working on this issue, and I've come to know many, many circumstances, it's a very complicated and important issue. And as I also work on education, what I have found, and I don't think this is any surprise to anybody, but these adverse childhood experiences, whether they come through neglect or they come through physical abuse, they affect that child throughout their learning, throughout their citizenship, throughout their possible potential. And so the sooner we can identify these children and the sooner we can identify these families, and my goal is that we can get in and keep the families together and work together. But in some situations, we need to go to the child's safety first. And so this bill that you have in front of you does that. And we start off with, we want to make sure that in statute the child's safety is the paramount concern. The second thing that we're going to do is we're taking out the language on preferred track. And for a little bit of background, you may know this, but I'll give it to you. And that is, when we assess an allegation, one of two tracks are assigned. One is family assessment, one is investigation. The investigation is moving towards the criminal, trying to build that case. Family assessment is that we're going to work with the family and we're going to try to provide means otherwise to get them on track. In statute, we're taking out the preference language, saying, it used to say the preferred response would be family assessment. We're now saying, let's put this in the hands of the Child Protection Services in the counties, and you decide the best track based on the situation. Statute shouldn't decide that. However, we do call out, out of substantial maltreatment language from the definition, that if there is sexual allegations, those immediately go to an investigation, which is part of the statute. We're just calling it forward in this bill. The next part of this bill that you'll have in front of you, and I understand not all of this will probably be in the jurisdiction of this committee, but I want to make sure you have the background, is that we're taking out in statute that any actions done in anger or without the regard of the child. We're taking that line out because, as you may know, you can still neglect or abuse your child, not you as the collective, but people can do that, and they don't have to be angry. So if you're neglecting your child and you're in a good mood, that's still a really bad thing to do. The next part of this is when a report is received, including reports that are not accepted for investigation or assessed, we want to make sure that we're looking at all the screened in as well as the screened out reports. One of the statute changes that happened last session was we took the ability for county social workers and child protection services to look at historical reports. There was good intentions for doing that. There was good reasons. But what we found is the unintended consequences of not being able to look at that historical has led to difficulties sometimes in assessing the risk of where a child may be. In the statute was ambiguous on, and I'm sure this will come into the jurisdiction of this committee, on what we do with screened out reports. Right now, in 2013, there were 19,000 reports that were screened in and screened, or there were 19,000 allegations. Of those, 14,000 went to family assessment, and 5,000 of those were investigated. Now, when a report, an allegation comes in, it is either screened in or screened out. If that report has criminal, as I understand, and there will be somebody that has more experience in this, if that has criminal, if there's criminal information there, that will be screened out and handed to law enforcement. So one of the concerns that we're having is, if all these screened out reports are now going to go to law enforcement, are we going to overwhelm them? Many counties are already doing this. Many counties are already taking those screened out reports and handing those to law enforcement. What we're calling out in statute is saying, let's make this a standard practice, because what we found is the biggest problem that we have is variability among the 87 counties. That not all counties are doing it the same way, maybe for good reasons, but let's try to shore that up a little bit, because we know these families can be transient and they can move, and we want to make sure that we're trying to put the best picture in front of our workers possible to make that case. I'll give you an example in my area. In Morrison County, when I've talked to the sheriff, the police chief, the county attorney, and the child protection, when a report comes up and that report is screened in, obviously it goes in the system. If that report is screened out, what this statute would do is that report would then go to the law enforcement of jurisdiction. And they would simply look at it. And they would say, do we need to take more action or no action? In my area in Morrison County, and in Little Falls, the city of Little Falls, the city police may have more information. They may have been to that house. They may have done something that they can add value to. And so we're not just simply screening them out based on a phone call. So that's what that does, and I welcome the testimony on that. And then the last piece, and if House Research will catch anything else I might have missed, but the last piece is the instructions to the commissioner when we do screening guidelines or when Department of Human Services put screening guidelines out, we want those to be implemented as soon as possible when they're received by the counties, which they should be. So as soon as they get notification and everything has come in, we want them to begin the implementation process. And the county attorneys have asked, and I think it's a good addition, that they be consulted before those guidelines are put in place, because ultimately this falls on their shoulders to how they're going to prosecute this if it needs to go to that step. The last thing that I want to add is, because it was a light, it was an epiphany for me, is none of this is mandatory until the courts step in. And that is something that I think we have to consider very carefully. No matter what track, and I can show you the chart of all the different steps, if the families do not work with the services that are asked of them, or if they don't take part in this, there's nothing we can do until it gets to a point where the courts have to step in. And that's what causes some of these problems is sometimes the families, obviously this can be an overwhelming thing. The worst day of your life and suddenly an allegation of neglect comes in, and I can understand that. So, but the sooner we can help them through this process and get them back on their feet, I think the better it is for everyone. But again, it's voluntary until they actually take action on this, which is what causes some of the problems. So that's my quick overview. It has been the most rewarding thing and the most frightening thing that I've ever worked on. But I will tell you, this is the passion that comes to this. And when you see the difference you can make in these kids' lives, you pretty much jump on. So I believe you'll have some testimony. Or we could take a vote, which is always great. And
well, we have to, Representative Creesha will move to a question of Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Creesha, you had mentioned regarding the reports, I think you said the change was last year, whereas they previously could be, the screen-out reports could be viewed, and then it was changed so they couldn't be viewed. There was good intention behind that, but had unintended consequences. For historical purposes, could you just elaborate what were the reasons for eliminating to be able to see those?
Sure.
Representative Creesha.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucero. There's a concern about the disproportionate amount of minorities that are in the system. And that is a very real concern, something that we're trying to address through other means. But my belief is that was the wrong way to go, because what we have done was we removed some of those historicals to try to accomplish a statistical number, when what we really need to be doing is bringing in more resources and addressing the problem of poverty and disparities. And I will tell you, the American Indians and the minority people of color are working very hard on this issue, and we need to get to them in other ways. So by simply eliminating those so we don't bring up more and more reports wasn't the right answer, because the unintended consequences, someone like an Eric Dean case where they had 12 reports and then the stepmother eventually terminated that child's life, there's other ways we can do it. So I want to make sure we have the entire picture, and my intent is that we go back and we work directly in those communities in other ways to help them, whether that be some ambassadors or we get some cultural experts in there to help them through this process. So if that helps, that was the historical on the intent behind that.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some questions, and some of them are going to be for the benefit of members of the committees that have never heard these issues. So once a report is made and it goes to a particular county, is that information available to other counties? So if there's a report in another county because people move, can that second county get access to the original report in the other county?
Representative Creesha.
And thank you, Chair. And thank you for the question. I'm going to answer it how I understand it, but I'll also invite, I think there might be a couple people in the audience that could help me as well. But from what I understand, that information is available. The counties can share it. They can do a request. And one of the things that came up in the task force is we try to make that information more seamless, so that as these families are moving from county to county, that the speed of that information is also with their movement. As I understand it, the information is available, and the counties can request it. The time it takes is through the request process and how they get that. That's my limited knowledge at this point, and I will
You can go ahead and bring them up if you'd like, Representative Grisham.
And I don't know who that might be.
And Mr. Chair, I have a couple of follow-up questions as well while he gets assistance.
And can I bring up, if I could...
bring up anybody you want.
The sheriff from Maurer County, who actually has been a great advocate and knows these issues much better than I do, and she has a uniform and a gun, and so I look to her.
Sure. Go ahead.
So do I.
So the question, Mr. Chair, as I see proposed, is...
Oh, if you could give your name and title.
Sure. Therese Amazigh, and I am the sheriff with Maurer County in Austin, Minnesota.
Go ahead, Sheriff.
All right. What Ron had said about how reports are received is absolutely accurate, and I lost my train of thought as far as where you were going with the last question posed to you.
And so if I could, so the question that was how accessible that is between counties.
It is accessible. It's a statewide database, and they ask for permission to use that database. Those screeners do. So it's a matter of having that available to them. So as these people move throughout the state of Minnesota, they can access those records. The problem lies is when we leave the state. We don't have that access.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when something is screened out, it's not entered in the database, I assume. So it's going to be forwarded to law enforcement. So when law enforcement does whatever they're going to do with that, is that shareable between counties? Because it's been screened out, they won't be able to search in the database. Will anyone else be able to access that information?
Sure.
And that, thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be, in many cases, a criminal matter. However, those reports that are not acted upon, you know, as far as charges or investigated by law enforcement would not be accessible.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when a report is screened out and it goes to law enforcement for investigation and they decide they're not going to do anything with it this time, so there's no record in the database, it's been sent to law enforcement, will they be keeping some sort of record that they received this so that in the event another screened out report comes in, they will know there was a previous screened out report that they did not investigate?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. We would have a record that we received this report and this is what was done with this report at this time.
Representative
Hilsman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question then. So then once law enforcement does that, if they know that someone's gone to another county, how easily is that information shared? Or if you didn't criminally prosecute, is it really not shareable?
That's the difficult part. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. This is kind of different from my world, so
no problem.
Excuse my missing the beat here. But that becomes the difficult part as far as the information sharing between law enforcement agencies. The charges are easy to track. It's those that are not charged that are not.
Okay, any other questions? Did you have any more testimony or any other testifiers that would wish to present?
I do not, so if it's anybody else, I'll open it up to those testifiers.
Mr. Chair, then I'll have one last question.
What's that, Representative?
I have one last question,
Go
Mr.
Ahead.
Chair.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you. So, Representative Carisha, so in the event law enforcement wants to get a look at the prior reports, that database, not social services, but law enforcement, does law enforcement have the ability to access that search, or can they get a search warrant to search those records, or is that information available at all to law enforcement?
Representative Carisha.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'll turn it over to Sheriff.
Sheriff.
Mr. Chair, we would have to contact Child Protection to access that database. And so when we receive those reports from another agency or a request, we would have to then in turn contact our Child Protection workers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is, can you then get that information through Child Protection, or do you have to have a search warrant or administrative subpoena or anything like that to get access to those records?
No. Sure. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. No, we do not need a search warrant or a subpoena to get that information.
All right.
When it is regarding a child.
Thank you.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kreisha, for bringing this bill forward. I just had one, just a clarification question, line 531 on page 5. As the bill kind of spells out the different forms of actions which can be taken against the child, you have here unreasonable physical confinement or restraint not permitted under this section, including but not limited to tying, caging, or chaining, or in a school facility, and then it goes on. I just want to know, would this also include prolonged periods of forced isolation? And what I'm getting at here is that there are lots of ways you can harm a child without harming a child. There are some kids that just they just get locked in their rooms, or they get locked in basements, or they get locked in garages, and even though they're fed and they're clothed, they're basically in isolation. And as most of us know, that prolonged periods of forced isolation, if it's repetitive, can be quite damaging, especially to a child. I was wondering if that's covered, if that's part of the equation here, or if that's something you'd be willing to talk about.
Representative Kreisha or testifier?
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Neuberger, for that question. This section highlights the definition that's in statute of the substantial child maltreatment. And we have talked as a task force about how we expand or contract that definition. And I will tell you, it is one of the harder conversations we're having because absolutely what you said is right on, and we need to encapsulate those cases, but we're trying to get the language right. And so, yes, I think the simple answer is yes, I would be open to that, and I'd love to take it back to the task force. And as we try to look at how we may expand or contract that definition, hopefully we can address those concerns.
Okay. Which one? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kreisha, I apologize if this was already discussed. In Subdivision 5, we're talking about the mandatory cross-reporting to law enforcement. And existing law requires reports to be made. And the new language, Subdivision B, says again that these reports have to be made. So if it was already the law, and now it's really, really the law, what confidence do you have that that report will actually be made? And this is based in part on my reading of the case that spawned this entire review, where those reports didn't happen to county law enforcement. What consideration, I guess, did this task force give to something other than saying we really, really mean it?
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Winkler. That's been the crux of the conversation, is the variability among the counties of implementing these procedures and making sure that we're consistent, and knowing that many factors contribute, lack of resources, communication between departments, confidence from the county attorney on how much they have of a case to prosecute. So you're absolutely right, and that's a really hard thing. Statutorily, I think the only thing that I can do is emphasize this, bring it through law, and make sure that we emphasize this. And then the law will also give DHS, we're hoping, a little bit more of an impetus to go to those counties and say, you have to implement these guidelines, you have to do this. I know we're dealing with a large bureaucracy, we're dealing with 19,000 reports, we're dealing with many kids that we're trying to get to. And what I have found in this is how you drill through all those layers to that one child and grab them out of the situation with everything in place and say, how do we save you? Because the reality is these children love their families, and even when we have to come in and take them out, it's a very traumatic and hard experience. And I'll put it this way. I was talking to one of our child protection workers, and they said to me, Ron, sometimes when we have to come and take a child, that kid doesn't understand what we're doing because they love that parent, even though we look at the very long list of things that that parent has done to that child. And how do you reconcile that? So, yes, we really, really mean it, and I wish we could really, really do something about it. And this is the best starting place that I have coming out of the recommendations of the task force.
Representative Chair, Representative Crenshaw, my understanding of the case that was reported on in the newspapers was that the worker, the county worker, did not make the report. And it's easy to just say, well, we can create more penalties for people who don't do this, and we can penalize, or we could potentially have counties actually have to develop a standard operating procedure and demonstrate to the department that they have a standard operating procedure in place, so that you put the burden on the counties to demonstrate that they are going to be capturing all these cases and actually following through. It seems to me we could do more than just say, we double mean it this time. But maybe that's been considered. I'm not part of your task force report, but to the extent that you've considered this, it seems to me that there could be an oversight function at the Department of Human Services or the Department of Public Safety to ensure that there is some process in place in each county to make sure that this pattern in the past does not continue.
Representative Crenshaw.
And thank you for that, Representative Winkler, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Here's part of the reason why you have this bill in front of you. The full task force recommendations aren't due until March 31st. And in that, we've talked about training. We've talked about mortality review cases. I will have a bill in front of you. I'll be working one that's very expansive with recommendations, because you're right, there is more. For example, and if you'll permit me to digress a little bit, when a case like this happens and a child their life is terminated, there's a mortality review. And we need to make sure those mortality reviews are getting out to all the agencies involved. And one of the hardest things we're finding is we need to get that to the medical professionals. Because a lot of times these medical professionals have to make judgments that may or may not conflict with this information that's in the reports. So what we're really finding out is we need better coordination. This is a starting place, and I absolutely agree that maybe we should have some oversight. But better coordination among all of the agencies involved would help a long way. I don't know all the specifics of what may or may not have occurred with workers in the Eric Dean case, but I do know that some of the early information is that people weren't communicating, that there was conflicting information, and that may have gotten in the way. We have to break those barriers, we have to coordinate, and we have to be able to look at information. The downside to that is sometimes that information may not be information that is factually correct, or it may cause other problems. So there's an error rate, and it's a very delicate balance, but I know that's a long way, and I don't know if that got to all of your concerns, but yes, we're trying, and I hope after March 31st we have another bill. Well, we will have another bill that we can take a run at this.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, just the last question to Representative Crenshaw, which is, so why do two bills? What's the... what's the hurry with moving one instead of getting the full package together?
Representative Crenshaw?
Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And so this is the first area that we think we have agreement on, that we can move first and that we can have the most impact right away. The second one, to be honest, is going to take a lot more legwork. It's going to take a lot more heavy lifting and a lot more buy-in by agencies, counties, and so forth, and will take some resources. So I'm hoping in working with the task force, this was the recommendation that we move this first, and let's come back for the longer, harder fight later.
Just a final comment then, Mr. Chair, which is I hope this first bill doesn't become the declare victory, achieve not enough bill.
Okay, any testimony from the public? Oh, Representative Schoen first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that Representative Crenshaw, that really does open up some other questions. Because this is going to have some, we're getting into an explanation of some serious financial burdens on the counties then if we don't, if there's, at some point that's going to happen. And that concerns me that that's going to get left behind because that's going to have a cost. And that we're going to stop here and go, okay, well, we put a couple lines in here that says you really, really have to report it to the police. That's just not enough. And... we need to do something. I'm kind of curious because I didn't get to follow the review, and I don't even know what's open, because what I'm more concerned about is in the Polk County case was the negligence on the part of the staff. So what are the consequences in that case currently? I mean, really, I think that's the question, is we have negligence on part of the staff. So then what are the consequences for the person that was involved in the case there? And that may not be something that he may be able to answer, and that's okay. But if you know, that's kind of a concern, too.
Representative Fuchs, comment?
And are we addressing that in the bill? I mean, if there's negligence on the part of the reporting, then that doesn't appear to be addressed.
Mr. Chair, so if you're allowing me not to answer the question, I will do that.
Yeah.
Do you actually have a question? What's your specific?
Well, my question is, so then if this is what we're doing, and I think I'm trying to expand on what Representative Winkler was going at, is if they don't report, which they were supposed to do now, but now they're really, really supposed to, what are the consequences?
Representative Christian.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Schoen, the consequence card, we have a child that's dead. And the consequences are that we brought this up in the press. The consequences are that if it's not that we just really, really mean this. Last year we had, in 2013, we had 17 deaths and 36 life-threatening. If that's not reason enough to push this down to these counties to start to be serious, and I'm not saying they're not doing their job. They're doing as much as they can. I get that. But I believe we have to bring the awareness up. And unfortunately, the death of a child is our impotence. And it's not just really, really. We have a kid that will not have a family. We have a kid that will not go to school. We have a kid that will not reach his or her full potential. That's serious stuff. And so while I understand the concerns of maybe a bill later that may not have the full momentum, I also understand that if we don't do some of this stuff now and we lose one more child, then I lose sleep. Then I lose faith in the human race, and I lose faith in what I do in my life. So this absolutely is necessary. This is absolutely the right first approach, and we'll expand on that. And all of that you brought up needs to go into the next bill and the next iteration. And if you'd like to expand on it already, I believe your group is meeting later this afternoon.
No, we're actually meeting right now. I had to leave the group and come down and testify. So we are continuing. It's definitely a work in progress. We're not just letting it lie.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. That was a good non-response. But the if we're going to move forward with that second bill, I mean, we got to fund it. Mm-hmm. And that takes money. So I hope we have everybody's support when we get to that point, too. So thank you.
Members, there is a fiscal note to this, but it's not in our jurisdiction, and that's why we're moving it. We don't like to let things go without solving the finance portion of it, so HHS is going to address the fiscal note, which comes out of their jurisdiction, I understand.
And, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could, I'd also like to invite the department up to help with that, but I also want to make a comment. If you notice in the governor's budget, there's no money in there for this. That's a problem. I think we need to have these conversations. We need to get all branches behind that. And so I absolutely agree with you, and I'm willing to fight for those resources. And if I could, I'd like to bring up
We don't need to bring up anybody. That's about fine. Finances if it's not out of our finance.
And this is in regards to the guidelines and the oversight that the department have in the questions that were raised, if that helps.
Okay, sounds good. And then Representative Ward had his question. You want to take? You can
yes,
tell.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Crescia, perhaps one of the other testifiers, I'm kind of building on these previous questions and was particularly piqued with your response to Representative Schoen's when he said, where are the consequences? And you said the child is dead. I understood his question to be more about the accountability for the staff. What are the consequences? I mean, we just say, okay, you know, bad job, you mess up. Where's the professional consequences? Because I don't think we've heard anything about that. And so that we know they have heavy caseloads. We know that there are real challenges. But I thought that was part of his question. What are the consequences to the staff so that we don't get to the point that we have all of these serious injuries? And I was also thinking in terms of your comment about these children love their parent, but I'm reminded of kidnappings where a child is held for years under very horrible circumstances, and they love, because that's they're the protector as well as the abuser and the source of everything else. And so we're talking about some really serious mental, emotional issues that need to be redirected in a healthy way. So I can't just let it sit that they love their parent. There's something really wrong with mm-hmm. the relationship that needs to be addressed as well.
Representative Creasy, I think all three of them were getting at is we know the consequences to the victim. We want to know the consequences to the person that doesn't do their job and doesn't make the correct reference or pass it on, like a mandated reporter that doesn't do it. Are there penalties, or are they going to have to suffer administrative penalties or from their business or their employer? Go ahead.
I'll make one quick comment, then I'll turn. That's part of the reason, Mr. Chair, that we're asking these reports to go to law enforcement for another set of eyes. Because part of it is additional accountability and additional... sometimes people just miss things, or maybe they don't have all the information to make the right decision, whatever that decision may be. But that's why calling this out and asking all 87 counties to send the screened-out reports to law enforcement so that one more set of eyes can help with that puzzle... that's what we've gotten buy-in for. Because I think while the sanctions and whatever punishment may come, if we can prevent this by getting more people to share the liability, I think that's a win-win. So to your question on the employee sanctions and that, I'll turn that over to the department.
And I think part of the problem was it's not a lot of us that believe 100% that they were just missed. Right. They were shuffled off to avoid extra work. And that's where we run into the consequences we're wondering about. But go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Koppel, the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Families in the Department of Human Services. And to those series of questions, I think it started with the reports. And just to clarify, one of the problems with reports was what did they mean by reports being shared with law enforcement? And to some counties, they were interpreting that as screened-in reports as opposed to all reports, those that were screened out, screened in. This clarifies that all reports should be shared. So that was the beginning. Then to the point of and just to clarifying that all reports should be screened or should be shared. And then the second is when the law is not followed, when bulletins are not followed, there are implications for employees, as the chair points out, whether it's discipline before having not followed correctly what we are now making very clear, or whether it's error rates, and those have implications for our federal reimbursement. And in some cases, when our federal reimbursement is cut due to those types of things, the counties lose their share as well. So there are financial implications. There are employee, just like anything, you know, we have a very strong county-administered system in Minnesota. We depend on counties to administer many programs, and when they don't do it correctly, there are implications for those employees, but also financial implications.
Okay. Representative Creasy. Anybody else? Is there Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, if I just could follow up with Mr. Koppel. So my understanding is that the reason, particularly in the Eric Dean case, that the report was not provided to law enforcement was because it was screened out, and that the only variation in county procedures is based on screened in and screened out, or was that just sort of, you know, it just became kind of pattern and practice among counties to do things in their own way and kind of based on workload? What's really going on? And does clarifying statutory language really solve the problem?
Representative Creasy or the testifier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, you are correct. There have been, as was pointed out in this case, but it was not the tip of an iceberg, perhaps, but indicative of some behaviors, which was that we had 87 different child welfare systems and 87 potentially different ways of handling reports and 87 different ways of screening those reports. in what we are doing in this bill, but also in bulletin and in the subsequent legislation, will be to have a much more assertive supervisory role by the state to assure that we do have uniformity and that we do have the core processes to assure child safety consistent across all counties. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Zerwas, or Johnson and Zerwas, and then we should go to the public and then move the bill pretty soon. Here we got a big presentation, but it is an important bill, so I want to get everybody's input. Go ahead, Representative Johnson.
Representative Creech, I want to commend you for bringing this issue forward. As many of you know, I've been in law enforcement for many years. I've dealt with child protection issues. I've been the officers that had to actually remove children from their parents and from their homes. And it's very disturbing to me that having to do that. But a week and a half later at the court hearing, seeing the smiles on those faces of those kids, when they get to see what a real life is like, it makes it worthwhile. There's a couple issues I want to bring forward. One is Representative Winkler and Representative Schoen talked about failed report. Section 4 on page 9 of this bill has that information for disciplinary action. Another issue is when these cross reports are made to law enforcement, law enforcement does not do the child protection part. They only look for elements of a crime. And if there's no crime being done, that would be the end of it at that point. But in my county, a few years ago, we had an incident where a child and it involved multiple counties, but a child was had a death, and it dealt with a child protection issue. My county got proactive, and they put together a very good program to deal with that for the cases coming in, and which ones to look at, which ones they don't. The individual agent no longer has that discretion. Any case that comes in, it goes to a committee of multiple people in that department, and they all look at it, and these multiple eyes are looking at it to whether to continue the case or to screen it out. And I think that's something that in the procedures that we put together, that's something that we should look at, so not just one person is being involved in that. And so there is just on the child protection side alone, there's more than one set of eyes looking at it. And then from there, it can go to law enforcement to see if there's any criminal elements. But we need to make sure the child protection is the first and foremost thing.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kresha, for bringing this forward. I guess for me, and I understand where Representative Schoen, Representative Winkler, and Representative Ward are coming from. You know, they're quite honestly, there's not a law we can pass in St. Paul to make a Pope County social worker go above and beyond. There's not. But we can unhandcuff those employees that really care about kids and want to do a good job. And by allowing these agencies to try to connect the dots, and that's what we talked about in civil law, the idea that one unfounded case might just be a bad incident or a bad day, two unfounded cases, three unfounded cases. But when you start to get where you have 16, 18, upwards of 20 reports, we need to allow our child protection workers to review that in totality. And we need to have that information sent forward to law enforcement and able to develop that pattern. And I know this isn't the end spot for the final solution for this problem, but it's a heck of a start, and it's a really good first step by the task force, and I urge the committee to pass it.
Quick response, Representative Creech.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas and Representative Johnson. One thing I want to offer out, because it's important to know what we don't all see. Stearns County came up and gave a great presentation. And they did a wonderful job about showing how when they have these cases, they have a team of collaborators from all the agencies, law enforcement. So to the points that were brought up, we're not going to fix this in statute. But we are bringing the conversations forward. We are raising awareness. And we're starting to see best practices coming that we can share with other counties. If Stearns County could just teach one or two other counties how to do what they're doing and to save costs and to save lives, that's a huge benefit. So you're right, we're not going to address all this in statute, but the conversations that have been generated, I can tell you, are incredibly powerful, and they've been effective, and they may not even require the dollars that we think they have. It's just a change in some practices. So thank you, and I just want to highlight, because Stearns County has a great approach, and I encourage you to see what they're doing, because they all come together and they share the decision, and we're not in a situation where one person has the liability of the world on their shoulders.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last question about the money. As these cases go forward, these kids will get guardian ad litems once they're in the system. They'll, in some instances, get public defenders. How does this not impact our area of the budget based on the fiscal note?
The MMB didn't come back with anything for us, did they?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, that is something that could be amended onto the fiscal note. Currently, the fiscal note was assigned to the Department of Human Services and the Department of Public Safety. I don't know if the guardian ad litem would find that there were substantially more cases as a result of this bill that they may need additional staff over and above what they currently have, but they're not assigned to this fiscal note, and that is something that we could change in the system.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that given that the public defenders represent these kids and guardian ad litems represent those that don't get public defenders, that we should probably add them to the fiscal note so we see if this area does have a fiscal cost and we should fund it.
All right, we can check on that.
Okay, sure.
Representative Shaw.
Mr. Chair, I just thought maybe it might be important to point out just in the public eye. You know, we've had some pretty pointed questions and statements from me and several other folks just talking about social workers and the things that have happened there. And that we obviously don't want to make sure that we aren't indicting social workers across the board, because we know they got into this business to take care of kids that are in need just like the rest of us here. So I just thought it was important to point that out. And you know, funding for these programs have dropped off from the state back to the counties by half, you know, I mean, or maybe not half, but a significant amount. And so the legislature, some of us that were here, some of us that weren't, owns that too. And that's just sometimes a byproduct of what's happening in our economy. But so we're going to have to make tough decisions. But thank you to all the social workers and folks that take on this challenge. So I just don't want them to think that we're being the bad guy here by asking some tough questions.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like us to be sure that we're looking at the whole system. I appreciate the comments that Representative Schoen just made, because it isn't about one link in the chain. But we need to be sure. I really liked what Representative Zeros was saying about unshackling or people to be able to do their job. That means they need the resources. And so I don't want to just say the public defenders or the guardians ad litem. We need to be looking at the whole system to be sure that all of them have the resources that they need to be able to do the job that they have signed up to do because they care.
And it was an interesting about the fiscal note, because usually when I've had bills, you know, ask for a fiscal note, they send them everywhere in the country in places you don't even think they would, and trying to kill your bill sometimes. And then on this one comes back without any reason. We're moving to HHS. It had no fiscal note for us. You would think MMB would respond with a similar query, you know, of the different departments. So if it does have a big consequence or whatever, then we'll address it again. But any public testimony? We're finished with our questions here. Anybody out there in the public who wishes to comment about the bill? If not, Representative Howe would like to move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know what it's going to cost me for that plug for Stearns County from Representative Cresha, but I will renew my motion to move House File 191 as amended and recommend to pass to be referred to HHS Finance.
Okay, everybody understand the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, Representative Cresha, thank you very much for your
presentation. Thank
you, members. Next, we will hear from the Department of Public Safety budget presentation, Commissioner Doman and Deputy Commissioner Dineski, and crew if we need them, right?
Great.
All right. And this would be a modified presentation, not everything that we heard in the overview, but mostly to do with the change items and budget. If you go ahead and begin your presentation, if you would, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. I'm just going to briefly say both we must have the plague going through the Department of Public Safety. We're sucking on cough drops and coughing, so we apologize if that is interrupting the presentation, but we'll do our best to get through this. As the chair mentioned, we had consultation before you started today, and we will be presenting. We won't be going through our entire overview of the Department of Public Safety again. We were just before you a couple of weeks ago, but we'll I'll go through the mission, and then we'll go through the budget change items from the governor's budget. So the mission of the Department of Public Safety is to create a safer Minnesota, to protect citizens and communities, to prevent, prepare, respond, recover, educate, and enforce in all of the different divisions that we cover in the area of public safety across the state. Our focus is on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services for the people that we serve, all while we are working our very best to maintain the public trust and build strong partnerships. Our agency is unique in that we're covered in two different areas, in transportation, public policy and finance committees, and then public safety policy and finance committees. And we will be going through change items today. Deputy Commissioner Dineski will be that cover. We have an overall change item, and then we have change items in emergency communication networks, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and then the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. If I could first, just because this is different than when we gave you our overview, this is the total base budget for fiscal year 16-17 with the change items incorporated. So our base budget out of trunk highway funds, it's $191,107,000. Out of state government and special revenue accounts, $127,622,000. Highway user tax distribution funds of $20,836,000. Miscellaneous special revenue accounts, $118,669,000. And then the general fund of $192,423,000 for a total of $650,657,000. And then our expenses in the categories listed out of transfers, $71,192,000. Local assistance, $128,220,000. Payments to individuals, a small 1% of $3,638,000. Total compensation of $305,233,000. And our operating costs of $142,374,000, which also equals $657,000. And now Deputy Commissioner Dineski will go through the change items in the governor's budget.
Okay, Commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. As Commissioner Dolman mentioned, there's four areas that we'd like to discuss that the governor's made recommendations. The first is operational support for the entire Department of Public Safety. Agencies were instructed to include a 1.8% increase for total compensation each year in their base budgets. This recommendation is intended to allow agencies to maintain their current level of HC operation. The request under the purview of this committee, as you can see, is for $601,000 in FY16 from the general fund, $1.212 million in F17 and ongoing from the general fund, $283,000 in FY16 for special revenue funds, and $573,000 in FY17 for special revenue funds. Those special revenue funds are primarily the 911 account and the fire safety account.
Mr. Commissioner, just for the members' information, that's why we run into problems sometimes when the governor's budget comes out. Historically, I mean, it's happened many times where either the governor doesn't allow for salary supplements, or they allow, like now, 1.8%, and it's almost assuredly, probably, that the law enforcement associations will come in with a figure higher than that, 2 or 3%, and then the agencies, I imagine, have to take it out of their operating budgets if they are successful out of the mileage and overtime, other things like this. So, okay, go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Commissioner is just going to move through those slide decks. Moving on, we have the Alcohol and Gambling Division that we discussed when we were here earlier. The State Fire Marshal's Office is under this section. The Office of Justice Programs. And our Emergency Communications Networks. And I will touch on this again because there is a change item here. The mission of ECN is to utilize emerging technologies to provide the most comprehensive emergency communication networks available. By developing professional partnerships, collaborating with our customers, we deliver customer-focused network solutions that enhance public safety. The funding for FY16 and 17 is $63.639 million, and that is from the 911 Emergency Services Account Special Revenue Fund. Since we were here before, I won't go through the services 911, and on the armor side, the governor's change item recommendation is for increased spending authority for the emergency communication networks. Increased spending authority for it will help ECN in implementing the text to 911, which is a priority for the Federal Communications Commission and the deaf and hard of hearing communities. It's also intended to update hardware components of the armor backbone system, which are over 20 years old, and to create a 911 interface to use with the state's GIS data set to accurately identify the location of wireless callers that now call into our PSAPs. The request is for increased spending authority of $13.413 million per year.
That's, Commissioner, do you have somebody that really specializes in that area where you really get into the nuts and the bolts of what's gone on in there in the previous year's spending and the balance of what actually is purchased with that, things like that? Not here, maybe, but is there somebody like that that exists?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. Director Jackie Mines is not here today. She does have all that information. We'd be happy to show you the complete historical background of where the fund is and what's been spent up to date.
That's great. We'll probably have her come in again sometime, probably just for 15 minutes or something. But and then Representative Johnson had a question.
Mr. Chair, Director, one of the issues that, at least in my counties that I've talked to and some other sheriff's office and county commissioners across the state, is especially in the armor system. Continuous upgrades to the system that the state's doing at their level, but it's a huge cost to the counties to make these upgrades. Some of the radios that they had purchased can do the first or second upgrade, but when you get your third or fourth upgrade, they're replacing all their squad radios, all their portable radios, and even their dispatch centers have to be replaced. And this can cost up to $1 million for some of these counties because of the number of the radios, not just with the sheriff's office, the police departments, the fire departments, and all the emergency medicals, the highway departments. It's with these continuous upgrades, and it seems like it's every year they're upgrading, that it's a huge tax liability to these communities. Is there anything we can do to slow this progression down? I know we want the best communication out there, but if we're changing every year, are we going too fast and not waiting to get the best stuff to begin with?
Commissioner, do you want to answer that today?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Okay.
I think I can be brief about it. I also have the privilege of chairing the Statewide Emergency Communications Board on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety. And for the members that don't know, The Statewide Emergency Communications Board is established in statute, and it is the body that actually governs the armor system. It makes the funding decisions and makes the decisions about when it's going to be upgraded. And so there is a governing body that, actually deals with that. It doesn't come directly out of the commissioner's office or out of the Department of Public Safety. To that point, sir, that has been a topic of conversation at the SEC before for a considerable amount of time. How often the upgrades come, how we notify people that the upgrades are coming. And in particular, part of the challenge is that a lot of people like you and I, sir, who've been around for a long time in the chair, remember the legacy systems, which were old VHF radios. And once you bought them, put the tower up, they ran for 20 years basically on their own. We're into a system now that's not unlike the computers that we're using here that require updates on a more frequent basis. And I think we're all getting accustomed to that. But the SECB, sir, to your point, is sensitive to that. And I think we have a new strategic plan that's coming out of that body now that I hope and that the board hopes will help educate users of the system and provide a longer term so that we can understand what the ramifications and the consequences of those changes may be in the future.
Okay, thank you. And go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, next we move to Homeland Security and Emergency Management. As you remember from our presentation before, their mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. Once again, I'm not going to walk through this, but clearly in the HSEM, preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation and prevention are their cornerstones. I will walk through this funding for HSEM. In addition to the extensive program activity, HSEM is a pass-through for federal, grants. Its general fund-based budget is $2.3 million per year. Funding sources through federal grants, mostly from Homeland Security and FEMA, are approximately $20 million per year. In FY15, a one-time general fund appropriation of $1.574 million and a special revenue fund appropriation of $2.5 million for railroad pipeline safety was appropriated to HSEM. And in FY15, initial funding was provided for a disaster contingency account. The governor's change item recommends to upgrade the public assistance management system and its staff at HSEM. Last year, there was a new program, a state-only declared program, where organizations and counties that can't qualify for federal disasters potentially could qualify for state disaster assistance. Unfortunately, HSEM cannot use the FEMA management system that it has for those state-only declared disasters. In addition, the budget funds, this budget would fund two individuals, two staff, to implement the new disaster program. What the request is for is for $430,000 for the disaster management program, which is the general fund one-time appropriation, $65,000 ongoing for the annual subscription to that program, and then $224,000 for staff to operate that program. And then, Mr. Chair, lastly, is our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The mission of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is to prevent, investigate, and solve crimes in collaboration with our criminal justice partners. Many of you were at the BCA last week or the week before and went through the tour. I'm not going to walk through all the processes here. Suffice to say that they have four primary areas. One is the investigative area. The second is the criminal justice training and education area. The third is the forensics area, and the fourth is the Minnesota Justice Information Services area. Funding for the BCA is a direct appropriation, $50.2 million in FY16 and $44.8 million in FY17. Of that general fund, $48 million in FY16, $44.8 in 17, and there is trunk highway funds of $1.94 million going to the BCA. The DPS initiative, which I'm going to go through now, is the main initiative for the Department of Public Safety this year and primarily covers investments in our laboratories and in our investigation services. As you know, most of the work primarily supports local communities across the state. This BCA investment initiative is significant because it will increase staffing so we can continue to provide specialized investigations that support our local partners and increase the staffing so we can continue the high-quality evidence analysis in our laboratories. And it allows the lab to implement an effective replacement and upgrade program that will bring our equipment in the laboratories current by the year 2020. In our investigative area, the request is for $1.6 million per year for our digital forensics unit to address the increased workload related to crimes against children, cybercrime, and other computer-facilitated crimes. It's asking for $1.5 million for additional staffing to address the predatory offender tracking, child pornography investigations, and human trafficking, and $600,000 a year to develop a financial crimes unit to provide coordination, experienced criminal investigators, analytic services, and forensic support to investigate identity theft and fraud. In our laboratory, the request is for $550,000 a year to increase the number of latent print examiners to decrease turnaround time, which is critical to local law enforcement partners because early identification and investigation can lead to the quick apprehension of a suspect, save law enforcement resources, and clear the innocent. They ask us for $300,000 a year to establish the mitochondrial DNA lab, which is valuable for testing badly decomposed bodies or skeletal remains for identification. This type of testing is always used in criminal cases on challenging evidence, such as hair and blood. $800,000 a year would allow the BCA to implement an effective replacement and upgrade plan that will bring our equipment current by the year fiscal year 20. There's currently more than $2 million in instrumentation and equipment being used that has passed its normal life expectancy in our laboratories. And $350,000 a year for supplies to allow the lab to maintain its current testing capabilities and case acceptance practices. And then lastly, we have a request for live scan replacement. Live scans are the devices that capture an individual's fingerprints electronically and automatically submit them to the BCA. They're used for identification of persons and for processing. It allows a person's identity to be known in a matter of minutes. Criminal justice professionals can make real-time decisions concerning individuals with whom they are interacting. As fingerprints can also be present at a crime scene, the fingerprints collected during the booking process are also available to be used to identify who was or who was not at the particular crime scene. The BCA maintains and disseminates more accurately, timely, and complete data when fingerprints are submitted electronically. We are asking for $1.3 million per year for 4 years to replace the 138 live scans that are reaching the end of their life cycles over the next two biennia. And with that, Mr. Chair, we would certainly take any questions.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the BCA tour. The only complaint we had was they wanted the aisles a little wider in the gun room and maybe some tables put in there and have coffee there and stay there longer. But I've got a series of questions here on the initiatives, and the first one, Commissioner, or whoever you would have answer, it would be, in the past, you had about $800,000 in the live scan account. I was just wondering how you spent that money and how many machines did you either repair or replace?
Mr. Chair and Committee, I'm Dana Goetz with the BCA. Mm-hmm. And yes, we had $389,000 each year since fiscal year 13, or beginning of fiscal year 14, excuse me, for live scan maintenance, and we have spent that on the maintenance of the current machines to this point.
So maintenance doesn't mean replacement, or can it?
No, maintenance is just when you replace new live scans, they come with an automatic 5-year warranty is included in the replacement price, and the maintenance accrues after that.
So the last biennium, you didn't have to replace any?
No, we have not replaced any since 2012.
Okay, thank you very much. The next question would be, what's the current amount in your annual budget for supplies on the supply issue, if there was an increase for supplies?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Kathy Knutson. I am the Director of the Forensic Science Services at the BCA. And to answer your question about the initial base budget for supplies, we currently have approximately $500,000 that is what we start at each year for supplies to operate all of the different areas of our laboratory.
You said you had currently had $500,000 and that's what you start at? You mean you haven't spent any?
No, we start at about $500,000 at the beginning of each fiscal year, but we actually run approximately $700,000 to $800,000 in supplies annually. So we do have to do some shuffling every year to try and ensure that we're able to provide the services that we need to for our law enforcement partners.
Okay, thank you. And then I don't know how many of these would have to do with the lab. Let's see, the current amount in your budget for equipment replacement. There should be at least $250,000 per year that we gave a couple years ago. Does that sound right?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct.
So the current amount for equipment replacement that you have now would be about?
It's approximately $500,000 is what our beginning base budget for equipment is. $250,000 was allotted in the last cycle. I believe that was in 2013, specific to equipment. And then we also start with about $250,000 in our base budget each year for equipment replacement.
Okay, how many? I think that takes care of it for that section. Thank you. Commissioner, how many prosecutions do you expect out of the financial crimes unit per year? Have you had any, like we do fiscal notes and predictions? Do you have any idea how much you'll be getting into in that area? Go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the assistant superintendent at the BCA, and one of my functions is I oversee our investigative division. Putting an actual number on the anticipated number of prosecutions in a particular year for a unit like this is difficult to pin down, and it really depends on the types of investigations. The Financial Crimes Task Force, which we have agents assigned to currently working on those, they range in number of prosecutions based on the type. So, for example, they're in the middle of a very large-scale investigation currently. Currently have about 5 active large-scale criminal investigations, but the most recent one they prosecuted had 28 defendants indicted, and so it tied up the resources of that particular unit. So it's difficult to say the number of prosecutions, but they will be very active and busy. We've had to turn down a number of requests from various police departments, sheriff's offices across the state to assist them in large-scale embezzlement cases, for example, in that affect their local communities.
Explain, if you would, sir, the relationship to your special financial crimes unit and the existing financial crimes. And you had said currently you had a large-scale investigation going. Is this a new financial crimes unit you're asking for? And who's got the current one going if you don't have one now?
Mr. Chair, members, the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force is a task force organized under the Department of Public Safety, the Commissioner of Public Safety. The BCA currently is the operating control of the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force, but it's composed of members from various police departments and sheriff's offices throughout the state of Minnesota. The BCA currently has 2 special agents assigned to that task force full-time, and there is a $300,000 per year appropriation that funds that particular task force for the affiliate members primarily. This particular change item would establish full-time BCA agent financial crimes unit, and what it would do is support the work of the financial crimes task force and investigations that I've referenced, but in addition it would give us greater capacity to assist our local partners, which is what we do in all types of investigations throughout the state, to address some of those cases, as I've mentioned, that we just have not had the ability or resources to assist those agencies with.
Give me the reason you don't use existing infrastructure and equipment in the one in DPS and just add more FTEs to that one rather than create a new one.
Mr. Chair, currently we do not have additional resources available within the BCA to assign additional people to this task force. They're assigned to their other tasks such as homicide investigation, narcotics investigation, predatory crimes, as we've discussed. This particular instance, this would be adding BCA agents to address a slightly different need, as I've mentioned, assisting our local partners. And in addition, what it would do is give some long-term backbone support to these task forces. The task force members are excellent members, but they do come and go, and as they're assigned to different tasks within their home agencies. These agents would be primarily dedicated to their expertise of becoming these expert criminal investigators to provide that backbone and support long-term, and that would be their primary focus and their only job duty within the BCA.
You might have addressed this in our tour. In fact, I thought you might, I can't remember how, but somebody asked about whether you actually recover any finances that you can use. What was the answer? It was not much luck, or what do you expect from that, the recovering of finances that we could actually benefit the state?
Mr. Chair, members, it really depends on the particular crime we're investigating, but in many of the financial fraud cases, there are victims that have been defrauded and lose money, and so much of the recovery, if there is any that we do recover in these investigations, will go back to the victims, especially in financial fraud cases. In cases where we recover, if we were doing an investigation, say a local entity or a government was defrauded, any monies that would be recovered for there would be go back to those entities that were defrauded.
Do you track that in case you've got a large amount of cash? Or would it be a separate track rather from your be way to separate it from your regular funding?
We do track all of our any forfeiture proceeds that we have. They're tracked individually by each case individually.
Okay, that's all the questions I have. Any members' questions? Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious on page 15, on the Homeland Security page on the change item. So you have $224,000 for two staff. So I'm just wondering if you can just talk a little bit about what those folks do, and then the $65,000 for the ongoing annual subscription. What is that? Thank you.
State your name and title, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. My name is Joe Kelly. I'm the director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. The primary basis of the need for the two positions, representative, is that our staff that provide financial aid to local governments typically are funded with FEMA disaster grants. And a FEMA disaster grant, we are given a percentage that we can use for what are called program management costs to pay staff to administer the program. When we have a state-only disaster where there is no federal declaration, no federal interest in it, the federal government will not allow us to pay our employees with federal money to administer a state program. These positions are categorically two things. One would be a recovery coordinator, someone to work with the local units of government and do the coordination of the damage assessments and the projects and those types of things. And then what we call an applicant services person, which someone who actually does the financial transactions to provide the resources, to provide the money, cut the checks, if you will, to local government. Does that answer the first part of the question, Representative? The second part is the $65,000 annual ongoing fee, subscription fee, if you will. What we are envisioning, what we are proposing is, again, because the federal government has a couple of systems that they track disasters, and by that I mean they track the individual projects that the local units of government submit for reimbursement. We typically do that in two federally provided systems, and again, we can't use that system when there's no federal interest. That program, if you will, which is a data management, record keeping, project management software, if you will, the prototype that we are looking at, of course, we'd go through the proper procurement procedures, is about the $430,000, and then there are annual subscriptions, there are upgrades, software upgrades, and just as with a lot of software and system things, it has a requirement of $65,000 a year in this case. Again, that is a rough projection.
Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for any of the testifiers. Does the Department of Public Safety or the BCA currently use any technology related to cell phones that mimics a cell phone tower and allows cell phones to attach to cell phone towers for purposes of investigations? And then part two of my question would be, if so, what is the amount in the current biennium budgeted for that technology, and what is the budget request for the upcoming biennium?
Go ahead, sir. You state your name and title again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the assistant superintendent at the BCA. The BCA does possess cellular exploitation technology that does have the ability to track cell phones as part of a criminal investigation or missing persons investigation. We currently operate, there is a law passed last year that was signed by the governor that requires some tracking warrant to be utilized unless there's specific delineated reasons outside of that. So we do track cell phones with that technology, and as long as we're following the proper legal process associated with that. The current, the question was the current amount for the biennium that would be spent on such technology. The amount spent on that technology, I don't have that number in front of me at this time, but it would be in the neighborhood of $65,000 per year, so $130,000.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if my memory serves me correctly, I gave you the authority to raise the money from through the 911 fee without legislative approval for the enhancement of 911. So I understand that you're coming to the legislature to get additional authority to raise the money, but if I already gave you the authority to do it, why are you asking for additional money, and what are you going to do if you don't get approval because you already have the authority to raise it?
Commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't, the change item, from my understanding, is we do not have the authority for, we have a cap on the amount that we can spend out of that 911 fund. There is money, and if we don't have the authority to draw any more than we already do, and I'm not certain if we have that number, what the limit is on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you already have the authority to raise the money. You may not have the allocation to spend it. But the question is then, why are you not just asking for an additional allocation versus additional authority to raise the money? Because I already gave you the ability to raise it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, good to clarify that point. We're not asking for authority to raise the fee. What we're asking for is the authority to increase the amount of the appropriation.
Okay. Member questions? If not, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And then members, Representative Hillstrom, we're starting to kind of, as the budget presentations get done with the agency, just push around some numbers, and if you've got any ideas, if you and your members, what's near and dear to you as far as cuts or stay the same or additions or supplements, let me know.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. And any other questions? Otherwise, we adjourn until tomorrow. When?
Tuesday.
That's right. We don't have a meeting tomorrow. All right. Thank you, members. Meeting adjourned.